This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. On this segment of the program, we're going to be talking about some major medical and estate planning issues regarding Alzheimer's disease. This segment of Your Legal Rights is made possible by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. Additional funding of the program is made possible by the Family Law Section of the State Bar and the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. According to the Alzheimer's Association, about 5.3 million Americans have Alzheimer's disease. Women are more likely than men to have the disease because they live longer than men. 11% of Americans age 65 and older have it, and about one-third of people ages 85 and older have it. My guests are Alma Sungi-Beck, a California Board of Legal Specialization certified specialist in estate planning, trust, and probate law, a partner in the Trust and Estates Group of the Lake and Spears Law Firm in Palo Alto, and Dr. Leo Conway Duncan, the Medical Director of Consulting Services of the Coalition for Compassionate Care of California. Her office is in Sacramento. Welcome, Leo, and welcome, Alma.
Thank you.
Lovely to have you here. Leo, would you do this, please? If someone, let's say an age in the 60s, et cetera, looks okay, but maybe there is something going on in terms of Alzheimer's starting to creep up, what comments do you have about this? What should someone or what should the family members do, would you say, just to be sure?
Mm-hmm. So usually or very often some of the early signs are quite subtle. The patient themselves may or may not be noticing them, but family members often do. And it's really important to follow up on something that you sense as being not quite right with a loved one and to have that evaluated. And when you do that and you're speaking with the provider, because theoretically we're talking right now about patients in the very, very early stages, it may not be obvious to the healthcare provider exactly what is happening. It might take a more careful, more detailed, or a more lengthy evaluation to determine that there is some issue with perhaps early cognitive impairment, meaning early confusion or some very subtle change in the way the thinking is happening. And so while families are saying things like, well, mom's not quite right, I can't put my finger on it, or she seems forgetful, or something's different, really, really important for providers to listen to family members and for family members to feel okay about pushing a little harder to get their loved one the evaluation that might be needed at that stage to perhaps confirm or deny an early diagnosis, or at least to put a plan in place to watch more closely. Certainly not everyone who walks in the door of their primary care doctor is going to need an MRI right away. But they should have a careful plan for follow-up, and the family should begin at that point the type of care planning and asking themselves the important questions about what might lie ahead.
What comments do you have, Alma, from the estate planning standpoint, with the comments that Leo has just made?
So, Chuck, where we see this in our practice is we're very concerned from the legal perspective about the potential of elder abuse. And if the family of an elder is not clear that there's anything wrong or they're suspecting things but they're just leaving things as they are, there's a lot that can happen in those first few months that are important to catch. And so it's really often the first few months where people might be interacting seemingly normally, but they might not be tracking things properly. And so they tend to be more vulnerable really just in those first few months to basically predators who come and try to, you know, through the email and phishing and try to get them to contribute money for their long lost friend that's lost somewhere outside the United States and has lost their wallet. And, you know,
Yes.
People still are very socially engaged. I mean, that's the understanding that I have from the doctors that we interact with. But from the legal perspective, that's often where a lot of the elder abuse happens. And then by the time that the family catches up and they're involved, then we have some options. So that's part of why it's important to try to catch it as early as possible. And I would agree with Lael that the family members who spend the most time are really the ones who are going to catch things. You know, I've had people come to me saying, I knew there was something wrong with mom. I knew it because I see her every day and there was something wrong. And I brought her to the doctor and they said, oh, she seems normal. And I was just like, no, there's something wrong. Please help. And so that's where it's a good time
when
to bring
in. When you say there's something wrong, can we be more specific? I mean, there's so many things that can be wrong, but are we talking about memory? Mm-hmm. Are we talking about recognizing people? Are we talking about, I forgot where I placed my keys? Or what are some of the early signs that one or family members or even oneself should be concerned about?
Memory is often the most obvious thing that family members will notice. Family members that might be having early signs of dementia may be repeating themselves more often. Mm-hmm. They might be misplacing things more often than you or I would, Chuck. They might be repeating actions. But it is important to remember, just as Alma said, that their ability to engage and communicate socially often is fairly normal. And it's also important to remember that they can have on days and off days. Mm-hmm. So they can seem good at one point and then not quite seem to be doing as well at another point in time. So if they happen to see their provider on an on day, they won't seem mm-hmm. very impaired. But it's more of a pattern that the family member would notice, a change in the frequency of something that you – of course, we lose our car keys all the time. I mean, these things are normal. I often go into a room and then I find myself standing there saying, you know, why did I come in here? You know, that's because we all are busy.
Why are we here?
Why are we here? Exactly. We're busy and we're distracted and we're thinking about those things. But there's a certain frequency to how often that happens. And if it's happening a lot more often or it's happening in a more serious way, then we really need to be taking a look. And I completely agree with Alma about the vulnerability. These patients are vulnerable to scam artists at this time because they're still often living independently. Yeah. They are managing their own finances and mail and checkbooks and everything. And yet, it is some of these more complex executive type of functions that may be starting to deteriorate a little bit because they are more challenging than a chat over coffee.
Let me give you, those of you I hope who are listening to this program, you might have a piece of paper or pen or pencil because there are a couple of things that I'd like to tell you about that I think are critical. If you yourself feel, well, I'm wondering, am I in the early stages of Alzheimer's, or if you're a family member and you're seeing a parent or someone very close to you who you are concerned about what's happening, there's a very good publication done by the editors of what's called Healthy Aging. It's a 2016 report. Focus on healthy aging in conjunction with ICON, ICAHN School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. It's entitled Alzheimer's Disease Advances in Prevention and Treatment. I highly suggest that any of you who feel that there's something relevant about this in your own family or close friends, you might want to give the organization a call. Let me give you the phone number. I do not have an email address for them, but you can call them. It's 877-300-0253, 877-300-0253. If you'd like to try to get a copy of the 2016 report, Alzheimer's Disease Advances in Prevention and Treatment. And also, there is the Alzheimer's Organization, ALZ.org, which would be very helpful for you to do some research there, and they also have an 800 number, 800-272-3900, 800-272-3900. One of the things I think, Alma, that I feel are obviously is very important in people protecting themselves is to have some kind of financial plan to avoid financial abuse. What recommendation do you have about that?
So as a general matter, we generally recommend to the public and to our clients to review their documents at least every 3 to 5 years. But particularly when you're dealing with somebody who might be in early onset dementia or Alzheimer's, like I was mentioning, I have a close friend whose father recently just got a diagnosis. And so getting the diagnosis doesn't mean that you do not have the capacity to update your documents, mm-hmm. but it does mean that you probably will lose it sometime soon. We just don't know when, depending on how it progresses. And so if the estate plan, like the power of attorney and the trust and the will and the healthcare directive, if they haven't been updated in the last 3 to 5 years, that's at a particularly crucial time to get people into their attorney, to their estate planning attorney, and make sure that it's updated. And so it's one of those things where when I get the call that there might be an issue with capacity or there might be concern about elder abuse, whether it's coming from inside the family or outside the family, that's often the first thing that I'll look for is, when was the last time that they did their documents? Is it updated? And particularly, I look at the power of attorney for finances and the trust, because they're, you know, as we think about, you know, where it would go and how long somebody might need assistance, whether in the home or outside of the home in assisted living or board and care, the expenses can really stack up. So it is crucial that people also make sure early enough, before they're vulnerable to a disease like this, to have a good financial plan that actually incorporates the real life potential costs, and that when they're at the point, 60 and older is usually when I start talking with people about it, is to have enough of a robust power of attorney that has the power to make gifts and the power to create irrevocable trusts.
Now, when you say the power to make gifts, what do you mean for those of us who are not estate planners? What does that mean?
You know, when I have capacity, I can go ahead and decide to gift property to whoever
sure,
I want at whatever
of course,
time.
Of course.
If I lose capacity and I have a power of attorney, my power of attorney is not allowed to make gifts on my behalf unless they specifically mm-hmm. have the power in the document and it's particular about what kind of gifts can be made. And that's basically to prevent abuse when somebody is incapacitated. But interestingly, if you're going to be planning far enough in advance so that you can do maybe planning around Medi-Cal qualification, there's some planning that people can do to qualify for Medi-Cal in the event they get to the point they need long-term skilled nursing care,
mm-hmm.
Or to protect certain assets from being recovered by Medi-Cal when they later pass away. Well, if you wait till someone's incapacitated, it's too late for people to do their own Medi-Cal planning.
Sure.
And so we want to make sure that at the very least, people have the rights, the clear provisions in their documents and their power of attorney and trust to do the kind of gifting or creation of irrevocable trust so someone else can do it on their behalf when they get to that point.
And who do you is there a certain person or persons or entities that you recommend to be the person who's in charge, the trustee of the irrevocable trust?
Well, so typically we don't really do the irrevocable trust for Medi-Cal planning till people are on the verge of needing it. And it becomes part of a plan where we have to time it properly in terms of setting it up and then doing the application at mm-hmm. the right time and in the right way. But in terms of who you would name as your agent under your power of attorney or your trustee under your trust, it's at some level the same question for whether you have Alzheimer's or dementia or not, which is you just want to think of somebody like, this person has the power to completely empty my bank account.
Mm.
And so it's a really challenging question for everybody, because you might have 3 children, and do you name all 3 of them at the same time? Do you name the oldest one? Do you name – I'm getting some head shaking.
I see Lael shaking her head. No, no,
like,
no.
Do you name a professional fiduciary? Mm-hmm. Do you name people jointly? I mean, there's all these different questions, and it's very case specific, and it changes over time, which is part of why it's so crucial to have it reviewed every few years. So you know, there are some cases where people will just by default, I almost think it's too easy for people to do their own power of attorney. And I would really caution people against doing that.
Oh, yes.
Because having an attorney do your power of attorney doesn't take a lot of time for that one document, mm-hmm. but it can save a tremendous amount of cost and headache mm-hmm. if you do it properly. And some people will just default. They'll be like, oh, I've always named my eldest child to do everything. And maybe it's created this horrible dynamic with your children. So what you need to be doing is thinking forward to what is the thing that's least likely to create conflict, and how are you going to set it up to resolve that conflict? Maybe you have a tiebreaker. Maybe you have someone who has the power. Like, you name one child to be trustee, but the other child has the power to remove them and replace them with mm-hmm. a professional. Mm-hmm. So there are many different ways to do it, and it's very particular to each family.
For those of you who may have tuned in just a little bit late, this is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're talking about some of the very significant medical and estate planning issues regarding Alzheimer's disease. My guests are Dr. Lael Conway Duncan, Medical Director of Consulting Services of the Coalition for Compassionate Care of California. Her office is in Sacramento. My other guest is Alma Songy-Beck, a California Board of Legal Specialization Certified Specialist in Estate Planning, Trust, and Probate Law, partner in the Trust and Estates Group of the Lake and Spears Law Firm in Palo Alto. And for those of you who are listening to the program live, and we are doing this on Wednesday evening, June 15th, in a few minutes I'll give you our toll-free number and you can call in with questions and comments during the second half hour of the program. Lael, would you tell us this? If someone has some level of Alzheimer's disease, are there any things, and let's say it's not so bad that a person is just totally incapacitated, are there some things that you as a medical doctor can suggest that people do to try to help themselves to slow down the progression of Alzheimer's disease?
That's a really good question, and a lot of research is going into that right now. I can tell you that in general, you know, some of the things that we would recommend would be the same recommendations we would make for any elder. And kind of as a baseline, of course, we would recommend good medical care and follow-up and a healthy, appropriate diet depending on the constitution of the person, depending on what their likes and dislikes are and what they tolerate. But to include a lot of leafy green vegetables and fruits and berries and nuts and so on.
And little meat, little red meat.
And less red meat. Yes, there's a long list of things. And while we're on that note, I want to echo your recommendation to contact the Alzheimer's Association. There are branches in most major metropolitan areas and throughout the nation. They are tremendously helpful and have a lot of resources. And I also want to echo what Alma said about having people choose their power of attorney and their decision makers very, very carefully. Mm. And there are some indications and some recommendations about how to do that. But to continue on with your question, so what other things would we recommend to patients and families? Physical activity mm-hmm. is essential and mm-hmm. really important. It helps to maintain the bodily health and the brain health as well, helps to keep people mobile, which is a big, big factor for quality of life. Also, a proper sleep, of course, and social engagement, which many people aren't aware of. But finding social connection and finding and having meaning in your life in some way.
Have some purpose.
Have some purpose mm-hmm. helps people to live longer, healthier, more engaged lives. So these things will help enhance the quality of life experience for any elder person and also for patients and family members who are managing Alzheimer's. But in terms of slowing the disease process, I wish I could say that I knew a magic bullet for that.
I don't. Yeah.
And some of the medications that are available now do help for certain periods of time, but they don't stop or reverse the process. And dementia and Alzheimer's dementia truly is a terminal disease. Mm-hmm. And many people do not realize that. It's actually more of a terminal disease than many cancers now, which we can treat and eradicate. And that is not the case with Alzheimer's. So if you don't have another intervening illness, such as a cancer or heart disease, and you have the diagnosis of Alzheimer's dementia, that will likely be the cause of your death. And the way that that happens, of course, is by the various bodily systems just slowly breaking down over mm-hmm. time. And it is often a slow and painful process, but it can also be a very quiet and peaceful process with the right medical care and support and planning in place.
If someone, let's say, has an internal medicine doctor mm-hmm. as his or her main doctor, what recommendation would you have for someone who perhaps is 60 or over as to what kind of doctor this person should look to see, am I someone who's in the early stages of Alzheimer's? Because as you have talked about just in the last couple of minutes, mm-hmm. it's very important you have the right analysis diagnosis.
Right, right. So again, in the very early stages of disease, an astute internist or somebody that takes a special interest in this area of medicine may be very competent to make this diagnosis and manage these patients and families. Very often it happens that a neurologist will be involved mm-hmm. and will help to confirm the diagnosis or perhaps make medication recommendations, because a lot of the initial manifestations, of course, are neurologic, and that is the way the disease progresses. At other times, there are specialist physicians such as a neuropsychologist that might be needed to mm. make an evaluation of the patient who is experiencing a more complex array of symptoms and emotional disturbances, which may be a result of an anxiety reaction to the diagnosis or may be part of the diagnosis and the disease process. And teasing that out and managing it in the safest way often does require a specialist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Elma, you're a certified specialist in estate planning, trust, and probate law. What does that mean? I think people need to know that in terms of what the potential may be for them if they have not seen someone like you.
The specialization in particular is a certification that you get from the State Bar of California in a particular area. There's a number of different areas.
There's a total of 11, including yours.
Including mine, yes. And when I was certified in 2008, we took an exam and had to meet a bunch of continuing legal ed requirements that were very particular to the specialization. But not everybody who does estate planning and trusts have that specialization. And there's actually mm-hmm. quite a number of very qualified attorneys who do estate planning and trusts who actually know how to do Medi-Cal planning, mm-hmm. Which is kind of I consider it a subsection of estate planning, but not all estate planners are familiar with how to do Medi-Cal planning. So I think that it's what's important in with patients with Alzheimer's dementia is, as with any degenerative condition over time, that you want to make sure that your financial plan and your estate plan are lined up to be prepared for the potential long-term care issues. Mm-hmm. And so Lael was great in talking about the medical impact and what happens in the progression. And I think the practical, like where people are living, becomes a question, because it often at some point becomes unsafe for them to live at home. And then the next question is, at least to live at home by themselves. So a lot of people start with some part-time in-home care.
Or relative, but that's still in-home,
you know, yeah, whether it's yeah, by a relative right. Or by a professional caregiver. And there are different options, but a lot of it has changed over time. So, for instance, the overtime laws for in-home caregivers have changed radically in the last couple years. And so while somebody used to be able to be paid 8 hours for a 24-hour cycle and just sleep in the home, they're now subject to the same overtime rules, and they're no longer an exemption. And so typically, if people really get to the point where they need 24-hour supervision and care, then they have to have three different people coming in. Mm. And the cost of it can be quite huge. I was just talking with somebody who was working with a client who his father was paying $9,000 a month for in-home care, 24-hour in-home care. And then after the overtime rules changed, it was $18,000.
Is this the overtime rule in California?
Or the California overtime rule specifically relating to caregivers, in-home 24-hour caregivers. And so, you know, while I understand for purposes of the caregivers and their rights and overtime rules, it's made it almost completely unaffordable for many families, something that was already quite a stretch. I mean, if you think about it, $9,000 a month times 12.
Well, that's an awful lot of money.
Yes. And so so I again, you know, back to one of your original points, which questions about financial planning and estate planning, there are things that you can and must do before people lose capacity so that people are financially ready for the potential cost of care. And then there comes a point in time where you know, you might have found a good placement for your family member in an assisted living facility or in a board and care facility, but at some point run out of money. And if these places usually don't take Medi-Cal. There's a very small percentage of instances where Medi-Cal can be used for assisted living, but it's usually forces people to go into skilled nursing, long-term skilled nursing.
If someone does not have long-term care insurance, have you found in your practice if someone is age 60 or over, let's say is in good health, do they have a difficulty of being able to acquire that from an insurance company, long-term care insurance, or do you have any kind of background in that at all?
You know, I can't really say it except through what I hear from the financial advisors who actually know a lot about the long-term care insurance or who are long-term care insurance brokers. But I do know that it gets more expensive and harder to qualify. You have to it's just like health insurance in some ways where you have to medically qualify for it. And, you know, the later you get it, the more expensive it is.
Of course.
But, you know, long-term care insurance, it's kind of a crapshoot because what if you don't end up ever needing it? And so then the question is, are you going to pay?
Should you have done it?
Yeah, should you have done it and have you wasted all this money? And so – and the other thing is long-term care insurance doesn't always even cover all of your long-term care.
Let me just give you, for the State Bar of California, the legal specialist number, www.calbar.ca.gov, and go to legal specialist or call the statewide number 415-538-2280 for a specialist in any one of the 11 fields. This is your Legal Rights, everybody, and I want to give you a chance to call in, ask a question, make a comment if you would like. Our toll-free number is 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. I'm Chuck Finney. On this program, we are talking about some of the significant issues, both medical as well as estate planning issues regarding Alzheimer's disease. My guests are Alma Songi Beck. Did I pronounce your middle name correctly?
That's very close.
Okay, all right. Alma Songi Beck, a California Board of Legal Specialization certified specialist in estate planning, trust, and probate law. She's a partner in the Trust and Estates Group of the Lake and Spears Law Firm in Palo Alto. My other guest is Dr. Leo Conway Duncan, the Medical Director of Consulting Services of the Coalition for Compassionate Care of California. Her office is in Sacramento. A couple of things I want to let you know about before we take some calls. Support for KLW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The San Francisco Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation in both San Francisco and Marin County. For a referral to a lawyer or the Bay Area Mediation Services of the San Francisco Bar, call 415-989-1616, 415-989-1616. If you're in San Mateo County, the San Mateo County Bar Association also has a lawyer referral service. You can call your own 650-369-4149, 650-369-4149. Anywhere in California, every county has a bar association and lawyer referral service. You can call your own. What they will do is do their best to find someone who's experienced in the area that you're having the legal problem with, set you up for a half an hour consultation, and with minor exception, Most of these lawyer referral programs start charge somewhere between $25 to $35 for a half an hour consultation. It's a great initial investment. That money does not go to the lawyer. It goes to support lawyer referral. By the way, also for those of you who listen to the program live, I want to let you know that next week, on Wednesday, June 22nd, we'll have our monthly Call a Lawyer night when you can talk with attorneys off the air in several legal areas while I'm doing the live on-air call-in program. So please join us for that. And what I want to do now is call on Skip. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Good evening.
Hi.
I have an easy question, I think.
Oh, there's nothing that's easy, Skip.
No such thing. A friend of mine became the power of attorney for her quasi-stepfather. The man she grew up with. And everything was fine. And then in one of his more rational days, he had an attorney make sure that she could not put him into a different home if he didn't want to. And the problem with that is not that she wanted to, but that it seemed to me that it took away the power of attorney that she had, that some other lawyer could come in and decide on his own that he didn't have to abide by it. How does that work?
So, Skip, the power of attorney is something that's, of course, done by the stepfather, and he can grant whatever rights he wants to in terms of what her powers are to manage his finances or his health care. I'm assuming you're talking about both the financial and the healthcare power of attorney. But typically,
right,
the healthcare power of attorney is the one where you can decide people's actual where they're going to live and what their, you know, what their situation is, and you have to abide by it. So the job of the attorney or the stepfather's attorney is to make sure that that attorney is absolutely crystal clear that this is what the stepfather wants. It could create a difficult situation for her, of course, because if you put a limitation on someone's ability to truly manage your care, then you could end up putting the person in a terrible situation where now the court has to step in and actually do a conservatorship to be able to manage things in a way that actually works for the health and safety of that person. And part of the point of doing a healthcare directive and a power of attorney is to avoid the court involvement. But I'd be very interested to know, Lael, about whether you've seen that in action in terms of limitations on what people can do.
It's not usual. A healthcare power of attorney is changed, of course. It can be changed by the owner of the document, as you pointed out. And to make such a selective request in the context of a healthcare document of that type, or in the context of a power of attorney document of that type, is a little unusual, partly because if this elder individual is incapacitated at any time, of course, and the daughter is needing to take action, circumstances may be quite different in 1, 2, or 5 years from the date that he is putting in that limitation, and his request may not be possible anymore logistically.
I think that he's becoming somewhat paranoid. He's been in the same apartment for close to 50 years, and he has no intention of taking him out, but he's starting to worry about losing control of what he's able to do and not do.
Right. So one other comment that I would make on that is that if she has concerns that he doesn't actually have the capacity to even make that request right now, that is something that should be evaluated from a medical perspective. And that might invalidate the change in the document that he just made. But patients with even some diminished capacity can very often participate in their decision-making process. And maybe one of the best things to do would be to get together with the daughter and the stepfather and an attorney who's skilled in this process, and to come to an understanding of why he's making that request and what the long-term goals are for him, and to have that clarified in a mutually agreeable setting.
Right. Kim, I'm Skip, I've got to move on because we have several other people.
No, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
If you turn your radio back on, I want to make a suggestion to you, frankly, with respect to the concern that you have. It's my feeling that people try to take advantage of the fact that they need to educate themselves. And the California Board of Legal Specialization, which specializes or certifies 11 specialties, including estate planning, which Alma is a certified specialist in, I suggest that you might want to look into making an appointment to meet with a certified specialist in estate planning, trust, and probate law. Again, I want to give you the phone number as well as the website for this, and you can figure out where in your geographic area the attorneys are and make some direct contact. The phone number, statewide phone number for the California Board of Legal Specialization is 415-538-2100, 415-538-2100. If you go to the internet, it's www.calbar.ca.gov. Go to the left of your screen to Legal Specialists. Click that on. Go to the county in which you are, and you'll find out who the specialists are that you might be interested in contacting, in your case, an estate planning attorney. What I want to do is take another call right now, and we have Amanda. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yes, thank you so very much for this show. It's an excellent, excellent show.
Thank you.
I have been on the journey as the only family member of a younger sister who was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's at the age of 32.
Ooh.
And I want to stress that I agree with your panelists that as a family member, I knew there was something wrong and I pressed for a diagnosis. I took care of her for 7 years, 24/7, and had to spend down all of her assets to get her on Medi-Cal. She is now end of life in a skilled nursing facility on Medi-Cal, and Medicare disability pays her share of cost. I visit her every single day.
Mm.
So much of what you have said totally rings a bell with me, and it is so helpful for people who may just be starting out with this. While my sister was still medically and legally competent, I made sure that we met with a long-term estate planner. And she had in place, before she was put in the skilled nursing facility, she has in place an irrevocable trust, an advance directive. I'm her agent. She has a will, and she also has a uniform statutory DPOA.
What's that mean?
Durable power of attorney finances.
All right.
Yeah, for finances. Mm-hmm. And I have the power she agreed to. She was still competent to do all sorts of transactions. She, about a year ago, had a medical crisis, at which time I transferred the title of her home into my name through the long-term estate planner because I didn't think she was going to be alive very much longer. And that title I now have in my possession, and I contacted this attorney to do it. So my question is this. Every year for her, I have to fill out a Medi-Cal and also Medicare recertification paper. This year, Medi-Cal sent me something I have never seen in all the years she has been sick, which was a very bold, colored, one-page issue that said the Medi-Cal Estate Recovery Program. And I would like to know, my sister is not married, she does not have a partner, I am her only relative, I am a sister, I am not a spouse or a partner. Mm-hmm. Do the legal structures I have in place that she set up in 2009 protect me from Medi-Cal seizing her property after her death?
So, while I'm not going to be giving legal advice...
You cannot. The state bar will not permit it. No,
okay.
I'm
going to
talk
that.
Generally yeah. about how Medi-Cal recovery works and how it might apply in your situation, mm-hmm. with the caveat that, of course, you should go see somebody that will advise you specifically on your situation.
Right.
In California, for California Medicaid, which we call Medi-Cal, you can qualify and own a personal residence and one vehicle and a number of other things, mm-hmm. including funeral crypts for all of your family members and mm-hmm. some various tangible property items. Mm-hmm. And so those do not impact your qualification for Medi-Cal.
Right.
So they're not – those items, if you gift them during your life, are not subject to Medi-Cal recovery. So that's the basic rule. Mm-hmm. If you gift there are two points in time that we look at Medi-Cal when we do Medi-Cal planning. One is, what does it take to qualify? And so for a single person with no spouse and no domestic partner, you have to have less than $2,000 in countable assets.
Right.
Countable assets are not those things I just mentioned, the
right.
exempt ones.
Right.
And there's actually a way, even when you have more than $2,000 in countable assets, through gifting into an irrevocable trust very carefully with an attorney to actually protect those assets from and enable you to qualify within 1 to 3 months in almost every situation.
Mm-hmm.
So getting back to the recovery, if you're gifting an exempt asset, then that does not have an effect on your recovery. And that's pretty much how the rule works.
That's great, because I have all the legal papers here in a chest. I know where they are. I read through them all, and that was done.
We're going to move on, Amanda.
Thank you so much.
I do think if you still have questions, as Alma has suggested, if you haven't seen lately a certified specialist in estate planning, maybe this is
now the time you're
concerned about this, to do it.
And right. particularly someone who has experience in Medi-Cal planning
yeah.
in particular.
Yeah.
Because not
yeah,
all
yeah.
certified specialists have that special yeah. have that experience. And so just the one last thing I would say is that there's some Medi-Cal planning that should be done in order to help qualify. There's some Medi-Cal planning that should be done in order to help with the recovery, which is exactly what your question is.
So if someone is on national Medicare, mm-hmm. does that qualify them for care in the event that they have Alzheimer's, for example?
Well, so Medicare kicks in, if you would otherwise qualify for Medicare because you're over 65, for
yeah,
instance.
Right.
Medicare kicks in for the short-term period for recovery until you get to the point where you're, quote, rehabilitated. And it typically expires sometimes after 21 days, sometimes after 100 days. And then that's the point where your long-term care, where Medicare
yeah.
stops covering you, and then Medi-Cal would kick in if you otherwise financially qualify. So Medicare is an entitlement regardless of your assets if you qualify because of your age, for instance, and Medi-Cal, you also have to financially qualify.
This is a very, very complicated area, yeah. in my opinion.
But thank you for underlining the difference between a Medi-Cal planning certified long-term estate lawyer and those who do not have that. I may be calling you, Alma.
Okay,
you so
Amanda.
Much.
Okay, Amanda. Thank you very much for calling. Our toll-free number, 866-798-8255 on Your Legal Rights. I want to let those of you in the Bay Area know that as of tomorrow is Thursday, June 16th, the San Mateo County Law Library in Redwood City is having a free noontime lecture. If you've gotten a traffic ticket lately, that's the topic. What do you do? Do you fight it? Do you pay it? It's a free lecture. Attorney Sean Mowry will discuss the basics. What do you do when you're pulled over, how to fight your ticket, how to save money, and even how to appeal your ticket. You're invited to this free lecture at the Law Library, which is located at 710 Hamilton Street in Redwood City. That's tomorrow, June 16th at 12 noon, from 12 to 1. And it's something that the library does either every month or every other month, and it's very worthwhile. It's a great educational experience. If you'd like more information, call the Law Library at 650-363-4913, 363-4913. Before we take our next on-air call, we have a question that was brought into the studio. A husband has Alzheimer's and needs assisted living, which is expensive. He has very little money. His wife has a small nest egg of $20,000, which she'd like to keep for herself. To afford assisted living, this couple needs to spend down their savings to qualify for Medicaid. How can the wife shield her $20,000 so she doesn't have to spend it down? Can she or should she hide the money somewhere and not say anything? Question mark. Should she divorce her husband? Question mark. Alma, this is another complicated series of questions. Do you have a comment for this person? I do.
This sounds like an SAT question.
It does, of course.
Or a bar exam question. So what I would say about the situation is that Medi-Cal does not cover assisted living except in a very, very small percentage. There are these experimental voucher programs in some but not all counties, and not everybody who applies for it gets it. So you might be able to get Medi-Cal assisted living coverage, and it's worth applying for it but not counting on it. So the question, you know, would be more in the context of long-term skilled nursing, because mm-hmm. long-term skilled nursing care is covered by Medi-Cal if you qualify. And when you're married or have a registered state domestic partner, the person that needs the care, again, has is only allowed to have 2,000 in countable assets or less than 2,000 in countable assets. But there are these rules that allow spouses and domestic partners to keep some of their assets. And so for this, the spouse can keep $119,220. And so in that particular case, if that's all the wife has and she has $20,000, then the husband, well, assuming it was a husband, would qualify for Medi-Cal and be able to get into skilled nursing. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of that's the way to go through that SAT question. But the thing is that I wouldn't do the analysis on your own. So yes. Again, like we keep repeating in this program, which is you really need to get somebody, a certified specialist who does estate planning, who has experience with Medi-Cal planning, because most people with Medi-Cal planning, it's not intuitive, it's counterintuitive. And so the things that people think to do, like sell their house to pay for their care, sometimes is exactly the wrong thing to do.
Yes.
Because now you've suddenly disqualified dad or mom from Medi-Cal because you've made the house value a countable asset when it wasn't a countable asset.
Very careful.
So that's just one of the many examples of where people inadvertently but good intentionally take the wrong steps.
You must be very, very careful. Additional funding for your legal rights is made by the Trust and Estate section of the State Bar, the Employment, Labor and Employment Law section of the State Bar, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. And we have right now Bonnie. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This is timely for me as well. And I have basically a comment, not necessarily a question.
Sure, go ahead.
I have a father with dementia and perhaps pre-Alzheimer's, and a mother with dementia, probably brought on by stroke. They're divorced. I am the trust and the DPOA for my dad, and I am the DPOA for my mom, and soon will be her trustee. One of the things I've learned, which I wanted to anyone listening to the show, is the process of my dad's decline was rather rapid.
Mm-hmm.
And so we consulted with an attorney, and it became over about a period of 6 months to update his trust and then for me to be assigned as the successor trustee or the transfer. It happened sort of right at the right time because the next thing I knew, he was really unable to do anything on his own. So just sort of an advice to people going through this, don't delay,
mm-hmm.
you know, because mm-hmm. the cognition sometimes just goes on a rapid decline.
What did you find the major issue that made you concerned about your father's declining?
Well, he couldn't keep up with any of his basic financial management, and he couldn't remember anything.
Could he remember you? Could he remember you? Or did
yes.
He could.
He can still remember me.
I see. Mm-hmm.
But I just was so surprised that we sort of recognized that it was happening, and we got all of the paperwork done and got a lawyer to do it all, and then he needed to do it when he was of right mind, right? You need them to make all these important decisions before they go into this rapid decline.
Do you feel that your father was in his right mind when you went to see the lawyer?
Yes.
Okay. Did you have anything else, Bonnie? Because I want to ask Alma something.
Okay, I had one other
go ahead.
Comment.
Yeah.
Because this is, again, I'm going through it all right now, is I have three siblings, and being the trustee for my dad, who has a decent estate, it's not huge, and we have him in a great facility right now, and he has enough money to pay for it. But I engaged my own trust attorney to advise me on what is my job as trustee. What do I do?
Sure.
Who am I obligated to? And make sure I do the right thing. And it's been really great.
Well, good.
Well worth what, good. You know. Just a couple comments.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you very much for calling, Bonnie, and because that's very helpful, I think, to all of us to hear what your experience has been. Let me turn to you, Alma, on this, and also you, Lael. If someone is Bonnie didn't mention that she was the caregiver, although I think a lot of family members, perhaps more often the daughter or daughters, become the caregivers. If you are a caregiver for someone who has Alzheimer's, what do you see, Lael, about the exhaustion level of that person?
It's a really good question. In the same way that you have to plan early and in advance for any medical or, pardon me, any financial or logistical complications that may come down the line, you also really need to anticipate what medical complications may be coming down the line. I'm sorry, guys.
Bless you. Alma, what do you have to say? What can you give us on this one?
So, I'm sorry. I was still thinking about Bonnie.
That's all right. I'll
situation.
Come back. I'll okay, try again. So, sorry about that, folks. So really, really important to have discussions with your family members when they're still able to participate in these discussions and to start to talk about the truly predictable eventualities that you may be facing and to consider what types of care they might want and under what circumstances and to really talk about quality of life that's important for them and what should be maintained and what are their goals for that care. Some people, for instance, want to live as long as possible on this earth, no matter what. Other people want to live in a certain way, meaning perhaps comfortable or at home, and they are realizing that they may be having a shorter lifespan, depending on what types of care choices they make. But to really explore that with your family member and to understand what is most important to them and to talk to your providers about the very real and difficult realities that could be coming ahead. And I mean the loss of mental abilities to recognize and interact with families, of course, that can happen. Physical disability, weight loss and weakness and so on. And the normal declining process that happens in dementia is to progress to a state of being bedridden and then to have difficulties with swallowing, aspiration, or inhaling of the mouth contents or stomach contents is common. Pneumonia happens frequently. Urinary tract infections. These are the result of the dementia and disability and can be seen as a sign that the disease is progressing. Whether or not you choose to intervene or treat aggressively, or whether or not you choose to pursue comfort measures or palliative care and a you know whatever care choices you make should really be thought about. It's very easy for families to be taken down the path of treating every little medical abnormality that comes up in these patients day by day, week by week, while they are failing to realize, and their medical team may be failing to realize that the declining process is simply part of the unfolding, the natural process of the decline in a dementia patient. And I would encourage them to think about this because I wouldn't want families to miss the opportunity to create a peaceful home-centered end-of-life experience for somebody who might want it. And that might happen if they're busy and distracted by these intervening illnesses and these events that happen for a dementia patient. So really, really important to keep your eye on the ball and to make any medical decision in the context of the bigger picture and the longer-term horizon, and to avoid interventions that may reduce quality of life if you want to preserve that. And we know that dementia patients, particularly frail elders, are really vulnerable to surgical intervention and to hospitalization. They get delirious. They can lose some of their mental and thinking abilities that they may not recover as a result of hospitalization or medical intervention. So you want to make decisions very, very carefully, always in context of what the bigger picture is and what the true goals are for the patient.
Well, that's terrific.
Can I add to this too?
Please.
So, you know, from the legal perspective, in that scenario you mentioned, Chuck, the concern I would have is if you have multiple children and one of them is the one that's taking care of mom or dad, and they're basically not getting paid. Maybe they figure something out, but they're not getting paid. They're not working otherwise because it's a humongous job to do that kind of caregiving. It's important that they get relief for what they're doing. And so maybe it makes sense to have some kind of part-time in-home help so that they're not the only one on call all 24 hours. But where we see it go south is where they haven't planned in advance, and then mom or dad passes away.
Yeah.
And then there's this question about, I should have gotten more because I just gave up a bunch of years of my life taking care of mom or dad, or I didn't get enough. And so it's one of those things where I think, again, planning is crucial, because if the family and the siblings can talk together about what they think is fair and what makes sense, then people can make the right decisions and not just make assumptions. Because, you know, I'm not sure it makes sense for, you know, everybody to get an equal share if one person's given up a number of years of their life. But how do you measure that? And there's a lot of inadvertent elder abuse that can happen on the financial end in that stressful situation where different people have different opinions on what the value of that is. So I think it's good to have those conversations early.
Yeah, exactly. And caregiver fatigue and exhaustion and depression are very common in this scenario where a family member is really, really taxed by caring for
it. It's very, very, very difficult. This is an extremely difficult situation. Again, I highly recommend to you, if you need some legal advice, I think you might find it very helpful to contact the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, 415-538. No, it's 415-538-2100, or go to the internet, calbar.ca.gov, and go to Legal Specialists and click that on. I want to thank both of you very much for joining me on the program. Great to have you here.
You're welcome. It was great
to
be here.
Very nice. Alma Songi Beck, California Board of Legal Specialization Certified Specialist in Estate Planning, Trust, and Probate Law. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And Dr. Lael Conway Duncan, your second visit here. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Medical
Chuck.
Director of Consulting Services of the Coalition for Compassionate Care of California, office in Sacramento. Alma's office is Lincoln Spears in Palo Alto. Your Legal Rights next week is all about mediation to avoid court and settle disputes. My guest will be Carol Kahn, Director of Public Service Programs, and the Bar Association of San Francisco's Alternative Dispute Resolution Program, and guest mediators. So I hope you join us for that. Your Legal Rights production staff members are program engineer Joanne Marr and production assistant Martin McLean. Funding for this segment of Your Legal Rights has been made possible by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, which certifies 11 specialties in the law. Additional funding for the program has been made possible by the National Board of Trial Advocacy, which also funds the public radio satellite transmission of the program. Thanks for joining us on Your Legal Rights Public Radio, and please join us next time on your public radio station. I'm Chuck Finney. We'll be right back.